You're listening to Long Distance. I'm Paula Mardo. Filipino food is something a lot of people have asked me to make a podcast episode about since I first started this podcast. Filipino food is everywhere these days, especially in the United States. I even talked about it on a previous episode, Hello Filipino. Listen to it after this. But long before the rise of boodle fights and ube cupcakes, did you know that in the 1990s in New York City, there was a little Filipino food spot that helped pave the way for the Filipino food wave we're in right now? Once upon a time in 1995, a quirky Filipino restaurant opened in Soho called Sandrion. Named after a French ballet opera, owned and operated by Romy Durotan and Amy Bessa, Filipino immigrants who came to the U.S. in the 1970s.
My name is Romy Durotan. Durotan. I'm the chef here, so I basically take care of the kitchen and I decide a lot of things with Amy, my wife.
Hi, I'm Amy Bessa, and I'm the other half of the team that brought Sandrion in Manhattan and later on Purple Yam in Brooklyn and Purple Yam in Malate.
We're at Amy and Romy's Brooklyn restaurant, Purple Yam, so you might hear some restaurant stuff in the background, like fridges and things like that throughout the episode. But going back to Sandrion, how'd they do it? Sandrion was not your typical hole-in-the-wall Filipino steam table or turo-turo joint. You know, the kind of place where you grab a tray and basically pick and choose things cafeteria style. Nothing wrong with those places at all. I love me a good turo-turo lunch with some sabao. But Amy and Romy were doing something kind of unprecedented, bringing the flavors and memories of their Philippine childhoods to dinner tables in America, taking Filipino cuisine to a whole nother level, way before anyone else did. They served things like black rice paella, lumpia with ube and pandan wrapper. Romy was even on the Martha Stewart show, making adobo with coconut milk, freshly grated on set.
My next guest is an authority on Filipino cuisine. He was born and raised in the Philippines and has been the owner and chef of Sandrion, his Filipino restaurant right here in Manhattan. And I'm happy he's here to share with us a Filipino favorite, chicken adobo. Romy Durotan and his sous chef.
Romy is the chef. Amy runs the business, though they collaborate on a lot of things. Because the restaurant business is hard work. And when they first opened Sandrion, it wasn't easy. Filipino cuisine was not mainstream. Far from it. And neither Amy nor Romy went to cooking school. They're former activists who sort of made their way to food through a sheer love for it. Still, reactions from people in and even out of the community were
mixed. A lot of people recognized the taste, the way we approach Filipino food. And then there's the other group that says they are more concerned about authenticity.
You have to fight for the soul of that restaurant. And when hard times hit you, you need to figure that out.
Romy and Amy named Sandrion after a French ballet opera of Cinderella, mostly because Romy was obsessed with its pretty funky logo. But this is not a fairy tale. It's a true story of a pioneering Filipino restaurant and the trailblazing restaurateurs who made it happen. Plus the unconventional path they took to America and the food business, and the ups and downs they went through to do something that hadn't really been done before, long before Filipino food was a hashtag movement. That's on this episode, Sandrion.
The reason I was in the United States was because I was fleeing martial law.
Amy Bessa grew up in the 60s in an upper-middle-class family in Malate, an old neighborhood of Manila. She majored in communications at the University of the Philippines. After college, she worked as a news assistant at the country's largest TV network, ABS-CBN. She lived a pretty standard, everyday kind of life until things changed quickly.
The news division was very, very anti-Marcos. So we would get soldiers all the time, trying to arrest the guests.
In 1971, Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Anyone could be arrested and thrown in prison without due process. The country was reaching a breaking point. Unemployment was high, the economy was down, while Marcos and First Lady Imelda lived large. Folks were angry and wanted change, but Marcos wouldn't let them have it. He had political opponents arrested, including politicians, journalists, activists, and students.
I had just graduated, but before I graduated from the University of the Philippines, I was a member of the student council. We were quite progressive at that time, very anti-Marcos.
Students were at the forefront of social movements in the country, protesting against things like U.S. imperialism and the Marcos regime. Many were arrested, tortured, even killed for speaking out. Amy knew she had to act fast.
I asked my friends, do you think you could get me out of the country? Because they had already suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And I knew the next stage was martial law.
At 7:15 p.m. on September 23rd, 1972, Marcos went on broadcast television to announce the Philippines was under martial law.
The proclamation of martial law is not a military takeover. As your duly elected president of the republic, use this power.
I was able to get into an exchange program in Germany. So I left like 3 or 4 weeks before martial law was declared. And I knew that it wasn't going to be good.
To protect the Republic of the Philippines and our democracy.
According to the book, Dictatorship and Revolution, Roots of People's Power, some 8,000 people were arrested and detained in the early morning before Marcos announced martial law. Under martial law, curfews were enforced, newspapers, radio stations, and TV networks shut down, both houses of Congress abolished. The country's entire government was controlled by one man, Marcos. A report from Amnesty International says that in this 9-year period of martial law, some 70,000 people were imprisoned, 34,000 tortured, and over 3,200 killed. Still, Amy thought she could go home when it was all over, but no one knew when that would be. And then she got some news.
My mother wrote me and said, "Do not come home because you're on the arrest list."
Amy learned the government had a file on her because she'd been a student leader. They had copies of everything she mailed home, like Snoopy greeting cards she'd sent to her mom. To be on the government's arrest list was a big deal. At this point, she knew she couldn't go home.
I was in Germany for a year, and when my mother told me not to come home, I applied to the United States, and I got accepted in a couple universities, and I decided to go to Philadelphia Temple University because my brother was a doctor there. At least somebody was going to take care of me. I didn't have to worry about my board and lodging at that time.
In Philadelphia, there was a growing community of Filipinos. Nurses and doctors like Amy's brother, and students like Amy, who was in grad school. That's where she met Romy Dorotan.
It was a Filipino student organization that was having a dance.
And we just went there to leaflet, to distribute leaflets. So just talk to people about how they felt about martial law and whether they were pro or against. And then we both got very much involved in the anti-martial law movement.
Amy and Romy joined the Katipunan ng Mga Demokratikong Pilipino, KDP, or the Union of Democratic Filipinos, a leftist organization of Filipinos in America whose central mission was to fight against martial law and the Marcos regime in the Philippines. Like Amy, Romy had activist roots back home. He studied accounting and economics at the University of the Philippines. He was going to be a business guy. But like a lot of young people, he joined the fight against martial law. After his sister encouraged him to study abroad and offered to help pay for school, Romy got into Temple. And he never met Amy at UP, which they think is weird too.
I came to America to do graduate study in economics. At one point, I ran out of money and I got a dishwashing job.
At an upscale restaurant called The Frog. Amy thought that was cool. The restaurant, I mean.
And I said, ooh. I really got interested because I really was interested in food.
Amy and Romy found they shared a passion for activism and food. Amy grew up with a love for baking and cooking, inspired by summers she spent in Iba, in the province of Zambales, with her grandmother, who everybody called Nanay, and whose food, Amy says, was unforgettable. One of her fondest childhood memories is of scooping up the sweet, lemony lime curd from the calamansi meringue Nanay would make her whenever she was sick. Romy grew up in Irosin, Sorsogon, in the province of Bicol, in a Chinese-Filipino family that mix Chinese and Bicolano traditions in their food. Think coconut milk and chilies, like in the simmered taro leaf stew, laing. But Romy wasn't cooking much when he first met Amy. And then?
The chef left.
At The Frog.
With all his staff. I was the one left there. And the owner said, do you want to cook? I said, I don't know. I've never cooked in my life, you know. I know how to cook rice.
But cooking seemed better than washing dishes. Plus, the owner offered him like a dollar more per hour or something. So he took the job. And he started out by making staff meals. Sometimes cooking took a little extra imagination, especially with ingredients he didn't grow up with in the Philippines.
If I prepare artichoke, it's not in our, we've never made it, right? So I tried to imagine and then taste it so I could figure out the Italian way of doing things or the French way of doing things. I started looking at recipes and cookbooks. And that's how I learned the vocabulary of cooking.
Romy enjoyed cooking so much, he dropped out of school and decided he'd keep cooking while being an activist. After finishing school, Amy focused on activism too. And since the activist job didn't really pay, she taught at Temple and...
During the summer, I would work as a pastry chef at The Commissary, a sister restaurant of The Frog.
It was a good time.
That was the time of quiche, right?
Yes.
I mean, you made like hundreds. He could make a quiche in his sleep because that's what everybody ate for lunch.
The ingredients are basically limited. You have bacon, shrimp, mushroom, spinach. One day I just so bored with all this and I saw all this avocado. I made avocado quiche. No one wanted, not a single slice. Today, probably it will sell like hotcake, right? I think that was the seed of my kind of cooking rebellion.
Avocado quiche. Totally rebellious and, in the late 70s, ahead of its time. For the record, I'd totally try it. In 1979, Amy got a promotion at the KDP and was transferred to a leadership role in the New York City office. She left teaching and pastry, focused on activism work while still holding odd jobs. Romy joined her and got deeper into his cooking career. He worked at different restaurants and eventually became a chef. But this wasn't exactly part of their plan. Remember, Romy was going to be a business guy, and Amy had gone to the States to escape martial law. What did you think the outcome would be? Did you think you would go back when it's all over? Was that your plan?
I never wanted to stay away. Even when I was in Germany, my plan was to go back home. But then, you know, when we got here to the United States, then I met Romy, right? So then we got married. So then there was a home here already.
In 1981, Amy and Romy got married and moved into a Brooklyn brownstone. In many ways, they were living the American dream. But they had plans and dreams to do something else, something bigger, something tasty. That's coming right up after the break. Tune in to Long Distance at longdistanceradio.com. Hey, Patrick.
What's up?
Whatcha doing?
Working on an episode of Long Distance TV, the video documentary companion series to Long Distance Podcast.
Cool. So what does it actually take to make Long Distance TV?
Well, after we figure out the story, I have to shoot, log footage, and edit, and edit.
Right. And there's sound design, mixing, color correction, uploading. That's a lot of work.
Yeah. What about you? What does it take to make the podcast?
I gotta do research, pre-interviews, book interviews, record interviews, transcribe and log tape, write, sound design, and edit, and edit, and edit.
Sounds familiar.
Yep, but we love working on this, right? And thankfully, this season, we have support from the Google Podcast Creator Program and from some of our long-distance listeners.
Cool. So if listeners want to support the show, how do they do it?
The best way to support Long Distance is to join the Long Distance Radio Club Patreon. It's a membership platform where you can support us while we make the show, with special perks and updates.
I can confirm there are special perks and updates.
But there are other ways to help too. You can share the show on social media and in real life, or rate and review it on Apple Podcasts.
Head to longdistanceradio.com/support to find other ways to help.
Now, back to the show.
All right. Edit and edit and edit and edit.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me your oath of office. I, Corazon Cahuanco Aquino, do solemnly swear.
After a series of political events, including the historic EDSA, or People Power Revolution, where over 2 million people took to the streets united against the Marcos dictatorship, Corazon Cory Aquino took her oath of office as President of the Philippines on February 25, 1986. That evening, Ferdinand Marcos fled with his family to Hawaii, where he was exiled until his death in 1989. He'd been in power for 21 years. Almost a decade was under martial law. With Marcos gone, those who left under his regime could finally go home.
I got to the States like in the 70s. I didn't go home until the 90s because Marcos was already gone at that time. I think it started 1991. I would go home every 4 years. And every time I would go home, I would travel and just learn what's going on. Just eat and find out how people cook stuff differently.
The 90s were a time of change for Amy and Romy. They moved on from the KDP, which disbanded. Amy worked corporate jobs while returning to her love of food. On her trips to the Philippines, she studied regional dishes and cooking methods, learning things like the different ways people made adobo, or the Spanish, Chinese, and American influences on Filipino foods, like empanadas, pancit, spam, silog. Romy cooked his way through popular Manhattan restaurants like Hubert's, where everything was cooked to order using local organic ingredients inspired by the new American cuisine movement and chef Alice Waters of Chez Panisse. But his rebellious avocado quiche instincts never left. A stint at a restaurant in Key West, Florida, inspired a shift in his cooking.
I started to look at the environment and what am I gonna cook. Over there, I saw tamarind trees, snapper. One of the dishes that I made was a coffee roasted snapper. My cooking was a Western point of view, but Amy guided me towards the taste of Filipino and the different regional dishes that I didn't really know.
After almost 20 years in the culinary industry, Romy was ready for a change. Amy was too. They thought, hey, should we open a restaurant?
So this restaurant thing came up. And some friend said, oh, you can do it with $50,000. So I said, oh, that was easy. And it turned out that it was not true.
But Amy and Romy were ready to give it a shot. As Filipino immigrants, they saw a need for a kind of place that would satisfy cravings of fellow Filipinos for the foods they left behind. they envisioned a place where they could serve dishes from their childhood, as well as other cuisines and influences they picked up along the way. And the two of them made the perfect team. Romy would be the chef, Amy would run the business, and they would both collaborate on the menu, using Amy's knowledge of Filipino cooking traditions and Romy's flair for creative experimentation. But before they got to restauranting, they started product testing.
We first started doing vinegars.
We infused vinegars with herbs and spices.
In beautiful bottles, beautiful design. And we sold them to Dean and DeLuca.
Yep, they sold beautiful vinegars to that Dean and DeLuca, the once ultra-popular international grocery.
Did you have a name for your company at all?
Sandrion Vinegars.
Sandrion Vinegars, yeah.
After a great product testing run, they pulled funding from different sources, which was hard. I mean, try pitching someone to give you money for something you haven't even started yet. But they got through it, and most of the funding came from a loan they took out on their own home. A huge risk. But by this point, Amy and Romy were all in. In August 1995, Sandrion Asian Grill and Merienda Bar opened. The concept was simple: Asian cuisine with Filipino food and flavors at the center. They used fresh, local ingredients to create original, unexpected dishes like quail and rabbit adobo, coffee roasted pompano, smoked spare ribs with the pickled Filipino relish, achara. In the afternoons, the front bar would serve merienda or snacks, mostly kakanin or rice-based desserts like puto, bibingka, and suman. Opening night was packed, and the food world took notice. Sandrion was featured in the Wall Street Journal, Gourmet Magazine, and the New York Times. In 1997, New York Magazine named it the best Pan-Asian restaurant in the city.
But see, there was no social media. It all, like, fell on deaf ears. When we first started, we were riding a high, right? I mean, we had so much publicity. That high will always come down. That's the restaurant business. I remember, I think what was like the second year or third year, we kind of felt that it was make or break already. It was getting scary because we were no longer getting those packed nights that we were getting used to. I think we had a lot of fights in the very beginning. You know?
Guys?
Yeah.
You guys fought?
Yeah, a lot. I wanted to kill him.
Besides fights, one of the biggest challenges was their concept. Romy says no one was coming in for merienda at the merienda bar. Apparently, New Yorkers preferred coffee and croissants to rice cakes and halo-halo. And audiences struggled to understand exactly what Sandrion was. Two Filipinos running a quirky, upscale Asian restaurant with Filipino flair, named after a French ballet in Soho, was different. Even Filipinos were skeptical.
A lot of people recognized the taste, the way we approach Filipino food. And then there's the other group that says they are more concerned about authenticity.
At Sandrion, you could nosh on whimsical takes on Filipino classics, like the sour soup sinigang with pan-crusted fish fillets, or purple-colored ube pandesal with adobo flakes. You could even order a shrimp curry or Balinese lamb shank. And to drink, you'd sip on rare Chinese teas and micro-brewed beers. They weren't exactly striving for authenticity, whatever that even means.
I remember, I don't know if he remembers, but we had a very agonizing conversation. Are we wrong in our concept? Should we have been more commercial? Because a lot of people will say, well, why don't you do balut, steam table? You know, all the things that you don't want to do.
Why didn't you want to do Duro-Duro?
Because there were already people doing that. Why do what they're doing? We're not good at doing that, you know. We're good at something else.
Amy and Romy put everything into Sondrian. Their time, their effort, their money, their house. Like a lot of startups, they were doing something so new. People didn't really know what to make of it yet. But Amy and Romy decided they'd stay the course. And for this to work, they had to make some changes. First, no more merienda. They serve merienda dishes like bibinka at brunch instead. They leaned into the Filipino-ness of their menu, adding more Filipino options, but in Romy's trademark style, and with lots of vinegar. Because acidity, sourness, asim, is a key component of many Filipino dishes, including three that Amy calls food that was always ours, stuff we were making before the colonizers.
I love adobo, and I love sinigang, I love kinilaw. So those are the three major dishes or cooking methods that for me define what is Filipino food. And they're united by sourness. And adobo is soured by vinegar, sinigang by sour fruits, and kinilaw, everything under the sun.
And that's the thing about Amy and Romy's food. They experiment and innovate while pushing forward the traditions and flavors of Philippine cuisine. They made food they were proud of, regardless of whether it was considered authentic. And it paid off. The Times critic Frank Bruni called the sour notes in Romy's cooking a, quote, taste revelation, and the kind of Filipino-forward food he was serving, quote, daring and different. Next change on the list, Amy, who was already on the business side of things, pivoted to manager duties. She welcomed guests and managed the front of the house. And she brought Romy out of the kitchen line at dinner so he could expedite meals and mingle with guests.
I just hang out with the people.
And people loved him.
Sondrian became more than just a restaurant. Take it from Sondrian fans and regulars, Toti Manasan, Karina Evangelista, and Sofia Romero.
Sondrian was trailblazing. You know, it was new Filipino food. You know, it was being redefined by this sort of daredevil craftsman, right? Romy. I was lured in there, I think. It was probably the New York Times story on the bibinka and the grilled kare-kare that was coming out of the kitchen.
What I remember very distinctly is how, no matter how busy the restaurant was, they would come to each table and ask how you're doing, how's everything.
Coming to Romy and Amy's restaurants, it's like coming home.
So, they did it. Sondrian wasn't just a great place to eat. It became a home away from home for Filipinos in New York City and for non-Filipinos looking to try something new. But like all good things, Sondrian came to an end. Amy says their rent in Soho was skyrocketing to something like $35,000 per month. So Sondrian closed in March 2009. Amy and Romy's second restaurant, Purple Yam, opened in Brooklyn later that year.
Hey,
10 years later, it's still around. It's where we met for this interview. Though the location has changed, a lot of the menu items and the owners have stayed the same.
What we're doing now, I mean, we're still activists. You can't teach an old dog new tricks, you know?
Are you guys old dogs?
Yeah, we're very old dogs.
When I first heard about Sondrian, I wondered why I hadn't heard of them before, why more people didn't know about them. And I think it's because Amy and Romy really were just ahead of their time. Today, Filipino food is so popular in the US, you'll see cocktails garnished with calamansi or ube ice cream at hipster grocery stores. Now, even New Yorkers love halo halo.
Oh, look at that. What is that?
It's halo halo.
Oh, yeah. Halo Halo. Dig deep and you hit delicious stratas of red beans, white beans, and chickpeas. Cubes of red and green jello, young white coconut, shaved ice. And is that flan? It makes no goddamn sense at all. I love it.
The late Anthony Bourdain and LA food critic Jonathan Gold, along with social media, helped popularize Filipino food more than all the print features on Sondrian combined. For better or worse, anyone can write a blog post about Filipino food, and it goes viral. But for Amy and Romy, Filipino food is not an Instagram hashtag or flavor of the summer. It's a lifelong commitment to exploring and innovating the cuisine they grew up with while preserving its traditions. Mainstream outlets like to say, over and over again, that Filipino food is finally here. But I'll say, it's always been around. From families who passed on adobo recipes generation after generation, to the first migrants who opened up kitchens and restaurants for immigrant communities, to the likes of Amy and Romy, who laid the groundwork for the new wave of Filipino cuisine we're seeing today, in the U.S., and arguably, the diaspora. Now, almost 25 years since Sondrian, Asian Grill, and Merienda Bar first opened its doors, these old dogs are not resting on their laurels.
Okay, you ready to eat?
Romy still mans the kitchen at Purple Yam every night.
Hello, Purple Yam.
Amy oversees Purple Yam Brooklyn and Purple Yam Malate, a Filipino restaurant in her childhood home in Manila. With Romy, she wrote Memories of Philippine Kitchens, a personal and historical cookbook first published in 2006, based on her years of travel and research on Filipino food and cooking traditions. Today, they're both still constantly learning about and experimenting with the foods they grew up with and love.
From my point of view as a chef and a restaurateur, I'd like to see restaurants and chefs broaden the scope of what they are serving, not just five favorites, you know, from lechon to kare-kare. I think there are so many other dishes around the Philippines that will inspire Philams here to study, to innovate, reimagine.
I would hope to encourage more Filipinos, Filipino-Americans, into learning more about their history and what goes on behind the food. To me, it's the best food in the world. I just really love it.
This episode was written, edited, mixed, and hosted by me, Paula Mardo. Long Distance is produced by Patrick Apino and me. You can learn more about this story in the show notes on the website, longdistanceradio.com. We've got all kinds of photos, videos, and links to resources used in the making of this episode. And you can watch a special episode of Long Distance TV, the documentary video series for this podcast, directed by Patrick Apino.
What's up?
This season of Long Distance is produced with support from PRX and the Google Podcasts Creator Program. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and Epidemic Sound. Theme song is by Sea Light and the Prisms. Special thanks to all the folks I spoke to for the story and who gave feedback and insights on Amy, Romy, Sondrian, and this audio story: Renee Gross, Mina Ramamurthy, Patricio Abinales, Christine Bacaresa Balance, Catherine Siniza Choi, Eileen Suzara, Vicente Rafael, Brian Ugadan, Nastasha Ali, Regina Espino, Alfonso Mardo, Patricia Pangilinan Mardo, and Patrice Mardo. All right, that's it for this episode of Long Distance. See you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening. And if you say you love me, I'll be the one to set you free.